go. And we're recording. Great. Okay. Vegetarian chili and rules. Okay. Dear editor, to the editor of Cuisine, Donna's Ladle is charmed to be asked to contribute a recipe to your forthcoming issue, Crowd Pleasing. We are not exactly a restaurant, but we can certainly use your guest chef's fee of $250 to buy shopping carts and bras for our own guests and a sparker to light the burners on the stove. Josie's eyebrows are only now growing back. Okay, so Donna's Ladle is what?
Soup kitchen,
shelter, you know, place where people can come during the day and the kid has a children's room. I love the name of the issue of crowd pleasing, right? Crowd pleasing. But when it says Donna's Ladle is charmed, right? Charmed. Not pleased, not honored, charmed. There's a little bit of an edge to that word, right? Because, you know, this is not your usual applicant to their to get their guest chef's fee. But the recipe, it tells a story in itself. You know, we have this one-page story, so let's read it. To prepare vegetarian chili, I soaked beans the night before. The next morning, after opening the church basement door, yelling at the mice, turning on the stove, and welcoming the patrons who have huddled all night on the portico, I start cooking the beans. Then I follow these directions. Sort donated vegetables, reject those too moldy to be identified, chop, do not let Marianne near knives, heat oil in pans, saute veggies, persuade Akeisha's children not to drown dolls in cauldrons, sit with Bridget crying over the baby who died, mix eggs, cornmeal, and milk in a likely ratio and set in oven, do something about Gretel's raw feet, combine veggies, beans, tomato juice, chili powder, skimpy, extend with yesterday's meatloaf. It's mostly vegetables, to tell the truth. Chili and cornbread will serve 75 generously, 50 very generously, usually serves 100 who are more or less pleased. Sincerely, Donna Crowninshield, chef. Okay, so what, this is a one-page short story. How does it achieve that?
It's fabulous.
Yes, and how so?
Because it combines everything in each paragraph.
Yes.
It tells you how to cook the chili, but it also tells you about the people and what else is going on. And
right. So when she says the recipe, yes, it's the recipe for the vegetarian chili, but it's also the recipe for the whole institution and the whole place. And in her recipes, in Donna's recipes, what you have to take into consideration, the ingredients that have to be included are not just the food ingredients, it's everything that comes along with the food, namely the people, right? Can't let Marianne near the knives. It's like all of life is included in this recipe. You know, the baby that died, the person who has raw feet, you know, and we have to do something about that. It's a recipe for food, but it's also a recipe for the love that this place gives out because they're caring. You know, it's about making the food, but it's about caring for the people at the same time. And the incredible thing about this vegetarian chili is, you know, she almost gives a paragraph. It would be a paragraph. But she does it in shorthand. Do not let Marianne near knives. You know, one ingredient of the recipe, right? There's a whole story there, but she encapsulates it into exactly six words. But we know what she means. And so this is, what she does here is really even more amazing than what she usually does, which is to, you know, capture it in a story. So it's a recipe, but it's not just a recipe. Donna Crowninshield.
That's really significant. Do you know who the Crowninshields are?
No, who are the Crowninshields?
I mean, Crowninshields are like one of the Boston Brahmin families.
Go ahead.
No, and in fact, there's a big award in the National Trust for Historic Preservation, their biggest award is the Crown and Shield.
Wow.
And so it's this very, very wealthy upper class family.
Thank God you were here, Lynn, because I had no idea. I was thinking it is that, you know, I mean, even think of what it means. You know, it's her majesty is in her protective nature, right? The crown is in the shield. So that's beautiful. And then to know that, you know, she comes from wealth and privilege and so on, amazing. Josie's eyebrows are just recovering. You know, they had a fire and the young woman got singed, a six-year volunteer. Okay, so let's go on to the main story, rules. What is the role of rules in our lives? What are the roles of rules?
It governs our society.
Okay, so, you know, there's that Hobbes and Locke, we're in a state of nature, if we don't have rules, we're gonna gobble each other up. You know, a society has to have rules in order for it to function and in order to assure the safety of its people. Absolutely. Great. What else?
That gives us structure.
Okay.
Rules give us structure.
Right. So there structure in our life is critical, you know, our routines. And when you say, we're going to see a use of the word rule in here, which means a pattern, you know, a pattern of behavior. The rule was, it's not actually a written rule, but it's a pattern. And we need these patterns because we need, in our lives, we need certain things, you know, there are certain things that we need to have to think about each day, but there are certain things that if we had to think about them every single day, you know, none of us could function. So we have these things that are already set in our lives, and those are rules. Now, what we're gonna see is that, you know, rules have different kinds of lives. There are the rules that are serious rules that, you know, non-negotiables. There are rules that are made to be broken. There are rules for which there are exceptions, or the exception that proves the rule. Rules function in a lot of different ways. So even though rules seem to be something, you know, absolute, you know, what we're gonna see, as we see with life, is nothing's absolute, you know. I mean, there are a few absolutes, but not many. Okay, so on page 87, one autumn, Donna's Ladle, a soup kitchen for women operating out of the basement of Godolphin Unitarian Church, became all at once everybody's favorite cause. There are fashions in charity, just as in bed slurs, sniffed Josie, who had been working as a volunteer since the ladle's beginning 6 years earlier. Don't count on this popularity to last, Donna. Donna never counted on anything to last, but she was grateful for the new help. A group from a local synagogue undertook to deliver cooked delicacies. The members of the Godolphin Helping Hands raked each other's closets for clothing contributions. Maeve, a nearby Catholic women's college, posted the ladle's flyer on its bulletin board. As a result, a few eager students appeared almost every day. Some needed firsthand material for term papers on poverty. The others showed up out of simple good-heartedness. Okay, so what do we learn about Donna and about the people who work at Donna's Ladle? So far we have Josie, but then we have the volunteers as well. So Josie already is showing us that, you know, she's a little bit of a pessimist. You know, don't count on that, Donna. And Donna knows not to count on anything. The rule is don't count on, you know, this is a fad, you know, so this is not, you know, you have to understand, you have to put this in the right context. And it's not that Josie's wrong. We'll see at the end of the story that, of course, she's right. But, you know, the fact that she needs to make note of that tells us a little bit of something around, about her. But you have a local synagogue and a Catholic college and Godolphin Helping Hands. They raked each other's closets for clothing contributions, right? So they have surplus clothing. So they you know, they're able to contribute. And what about the students from the college?
Summer, doing it out of the goodness of your heart.
Right.
Get her schoolwork.
Right. And so people come to good work and charitable work for many different motivations. And some, you know, is total altruism. Some, there's something in there that they need. Does it really matter? No, as long as they give the help. You know, I mean, you know, from a Jewish perspective, they, you know, it matters the action and the fact that they're coming. You know, okay, gig is into hay, have your, you know, write your term paper. But it's great that you're there to volunteer. Mother Teresa's in designer jeans, said Josie privately to Donna. But to the Maeve students, Josie was a model of patience. In repairing the Cuisinart whenever they broke it, demonstrating a restrained kindness toward the guests that the girls meant to emulate, really they did. They just couldn't help overreacting to the tragic tales they heard. They were frequently in tears. Their eyes, even when red with weeping, were large and lovely. So Josie may be a bit of a pessimist, a bit of a skeptic herself, but she's nothing but kind to the volunteers. And you know, and she understands that their heart is really in the right place. Just skip down a little bit. Her colleagues laughed at this distortion, orthodontia as child abuse. They were not caseworkers, not sociologists, not child advocates. They were the staff of the ladle, three overworked young women, but they had seen children who had been abused. Why not caseworkers, not sociologists, not child advocates? Why does she do that? Why is Edith, what is Edith Perlman trying to tell us?
They're not professional.
They're not professional, and by the way, you don't need a degree to change the world, right? You know, they're three overworked women, but they have some experience. Seeing the abuse of a child is not something new to them. They have experience, even if they don't have credentials. They had broken bread with the abusers. They had witnessed and put a stop to beatings by enraged mothers. You can't hit anybody here, they each knew how to say in a voice both authoritative and uncensuring. A few weeks ago, Pam, turning white with fury after the event, reported to the others that she had interrupted Concepta peppering her grandson, a niño of 18 months. Peppering him, asked Donna. Peppering him with what? Peppering him with pepper. She had him on her lap and she was shaking the pepper jar over him as if he were a pizza. I don't think any got into his eyes, but I wanted to strangle the bitch. Pam bit her lip and bent her curly head. So we have the first real rule, which they enforce, right? Which is you can't hit anybody here. They enforce that rule. You know, there are some things that are non-negotiable. If you're gonna hit, you don't stay here. So that's that is a hard and fast rule. But then there are things that, you know, are equivalent or worse than hitting that they can't outlaw, right? You know, this mother is pouring pepper on this 18-month-old child and, you know, they can ask or they can take the child and say, oh, I'll hold him for you a little bit. They can do whatever they can do. But as it turn on the next side of the page, one of the, Pam says, what else could I do? She had to give the baby back. Not a thing, said Beth softly, her plump little hand stirring in her lap. Not a damn thing, said Donna. Reporting incidents to the authorities was out of the question. Another rule, right? And why don't they report incidents to the authorities?
They'll never see these people. Right.
You know, there are certain things, you know, that from the outside, you know, you could say, well, why aren't they reporting them? Why aren't they? No, there's a larger context here, which is if they reported them, they would not be able to do the help. So they decide which battles they're going to fight. And in order for them to help these people, they're going to have to do something that from the outside you'd say, well, you know, maybe they really should be reporting them. But no, you have to be able to see the whole picture. And that goes to one of the messages that we've seen before, and we're going to see more here, which is we can't really rush to judgment about certain things, because the way they look from the outside doesn't always tell the whole story. Like, you know, if you see somebody doing something wrong, and or you see a bystander watching somebody commit a crime and he doesn't do anything about it, you immediately assume the worst about him, right? Which is what you could assume about these women. But no, that's not the case. Don't assume a negative thing about them. It's actually, they've made a calculation here. And this is the cost that goes into being able to do the benefit, which is give a place for these people. So just skip down to the bottom. As far as the staff knew, Ricky did not have AIDS, but the staff didn't know very much. You know, there's Concepta is keeping her baby away from Ricky, and you know, and so on. Okay, some things they did know. They knew that little kids who came in like stuffed animals and trucks and toys you could ride and toys you could climb into. They liked crayons and paint. They didn't like to put things away. They liked to hurl things around. And they liked to hurl themselves around and to sit on laps. They enjoyed ice cream, though they were fearful of getting themselves dirty. They were loud and possessive and self-centered, but they had learned somewhere that when you grabbed a toy from another child, you had to shout, "Share!" So here's a wonderful misunderstanding of a rule, right? You know, they get what it looks like, you know. The minute somebody, you know, if somebody grabs a toy, you're supposed to share toys. You know, so they understand that, but they kind of miss the point. And that's possible with rules, right? You can go to the letter, you know, you can obey the rule to the letter and totally miss the spirit, right? But some things they did know. These three women, they may not have known all the details, partly because there are some details they knew they couldn't do anything about, so better not to know. But what they did know is, so what did they know? In addition, you know, by all these examples that they give us, that she gives us. So they get kids. They know kids.
They knew how to treat the kids.
They knew how to treat kids. They knew that kids don't like to put things away. You know, there are things that in order to actually be able to offer a good place for children, you have to understand them some. And they enjoyed ice cream, though they were fearful of getting themselves dirty. Now here it tells you that they don't just know children, they know very specific children from very specific families and what are the consequences of certain things happening, right? But when their aunt, mothers or aunts or grandmothers or fathers, girlfriends retrieve them after lunch, something frightened could be felt to uncoil within certain of these stained, smelly little persons. The children did their part in the rough ceremony of reunion. Where the fuck's your cap? Did you make a mess like always? By producing an article of clothing or fainting at mopping some milk. But the staff felt their hearts sink, and the maves claimed that theirs broken too at the premonition of outrage that might follow back in the welfare motel or the scabby apartment or the room grudgingly loaned by a sister-in-law, places where even the bare bones rules of Donna's ladle did not prevail. Meaning, these are places where the kids get hit plenty, right? And so what do we see in this paragraph, these rough reunions? These women may know something about children, and they might know how to be very kind to children, but these children come from families where their parents may not know how to parent, you know, or have gotten really ideas about parenting, like cut down the kids. Did you make a mess like always? Where is your cap? Speaking terribly to children, right? So the parents of these children, it's hard to give the kids back into their care, right? Because you knew what was coming. And this always reminds me of this one student who I knew, who at least by his own telling, but we couldn't otherwise confirm it, but we were pretty sure that his parents, his father particularly, was beating him in a bad way. Regularly, he would get a whopping before he came to school in the morning. And you think for a kid who could, come into class with, even let's say, it had been investigated and, no evidence that the father was doing it. A kid who comes into class and tells you that he's been hit in the morning, it's like, how can you learn anything, when that's what you're coming in with at the beginning of a day? But he had such a nice morning, shuddered a Maeve one mild November afternoon. And listening to Nathaniel's mother, you do what I say, here or else. Or else means, may mean no more than a slap, said Donna to the worried girl. And he did have a nice morning. That's important. When you're fighting such a tough situation, the little victories are really important and really important to note. It does make a difference that he had a nice morning, because that gives him a sense of what a nice morning looks like, where he might not have had that sense before. And maybe if he can imagine it and see it, maybe he can recreate it when he has agency and is able to make his own choices. It was important to keep the children's room open, even though maintaining the play area meant that there were fewer hands making lunch in the kitchen. So skip to the next side of the page, 91. But the erect and solemn girl of about 7 who appeared one December morning was not wearing the cast-offs of a Godolphin child, not of a 20th century child anyway. Her long dress of gray flannel might have belonged to an early citizen of Massachusetts Bay if it had not had a back zipper. The woman who accompanied the child was garbed also in a plain home-sewn dress. They wore identical brown capes. Each had a single braid, thick and fair. The child's straight-browed gray eyes resembled her mother's, but the girl lacked the scar that ran down the left side of the woman's face from the lower lid to the middle of the cheek. When they arrived, Beth was circulating through the large basement dining room with a tray of knishes. Where might they have come from? The local synagogue. Hello, she said, I'm Beth. A silence followed. Yes, said the woman at last. At Donna's ladle, the staff restricted its questions to matters of food and comfort. Another rule, an important rule, right? And so would you like a meat pastry? Said Beth. Bending down to the child, take two. But the child, with murmured thanks, took only one. That is not usual. That's not, take two. They don't usually say no thanks, right? Beth straightened up. We're glad to have you with us, she said. Please feel at home. We serve lunch at noon. Sit at any table. Breakfast fixings are on the buffet against the wall. The quiet room is behind you, and she pointed with her free hand. The children's room is next to it, she backed away. Feel at home, she repeated weakly, realizing this couple would not feel at home anywhere. And yet, they had come to this place. So they were seeking some place that was either, they were seeking some place to be at home at least for a little while, right? And but here you have Beth looking at this couple and really this mother and daughter and not understanding them. This is more unusual than the unusual that they see. Okay, so let's keep going about these, the mother and child. 92. Donna shifted her gaze to the next table. She saw the new guests. They were seated side by side. The child's hands clasped rested on the table. The mother's hands lay in her lap. Each was attentive to the space in front of her eyes, to the vision of some new Jerusalem, Donna suspected. Adventuresses, do you think? I'll have a chat with poor Bitsy. Actresses on their lunch break, suggested Pam at Donna's other shoulder. What's that Arthur Miller play? The Crucible, said Donna. Pam moved off. They're like from another world, breathed the Maeve, who had replaced Beth. And Josie had replaced Pam. Weirdos. So we can see how they all jump to various conclusions, right? Donna immediately thinks, oh, they're dreaming of a new Jerusalem. And there, you know, there's an edge to that comment, right? Maybe, you know, and Pam likes to inject a little humor. Maybe they're actresses, you know, with the capes and the clothing that doesn't look like it's of this century. Josie, who just says it like, you know, tells it like she sees it, they're strange. Donna didn't reply. These newcomers were not the poor she had always with her. She was used to cheats and crazies, drunks and dealers. She was fond of little retired chambermaids whose voices still shivered with brogues. They relied on the ladle to augment their pitiful pensions. She liked hot-tempered sisters from the South and the South Bronx. She viewed with puzzled respect magic mongers from the islands. And she was even accustomed to certain outspoken religious zealots, shrews of Christ, Josie called them. But plain living Puritans? What were they doing in her facility? The pair didn't look needle, but the ladle's policy must hold. No prying. Another rule. Among the guests were a few batty gentlewomen who might well possess million-dollar trust funds, who probably lunched at the Ritz on the days the ladle was closed. They were served without question. So too would this mother and daughter be served. It was the rule. That's a good rule, right? We serve everybody, even if they're not poor, even if they're not like, you know, people we've seen before. But there's definitely, you can hear a skepticism in Donna's thinking about them, which just increases. The woman's name was Senia, I'm on 93. The child was Rhea. Senia was separated from Rhea's father, a clergyman. Senia and Rhea lived in two basement rooms just over the line in Boston. They received a monthly check from the clergyman. It met their wants, but only barely, said Senia to Dinah. We are grateful to the ladle for our breakfasts and lunches. So she explains, they don't ask, but she explains why they're there and what they need it for. I'm so glad, but there are other sources you could tap too. The state government supplements inadequate incomes and the city itself. No. After a few minutes, Donna said idly, we sometimes hear of jobs, tailoring work. Rhea is my work. Donna looked at the severe little girl who was reading a thick book, the Bible. It was Grimm's, she reported that week, in the modern library edition. No pictures, impressive. Sin teaches her at home. Is that against the law? No, said Pam, and then looked down at her hiking boots. She was terrified of seeming to show off. Tell us, Donna laughed. What is Donna trying, when she's making these suggestions to Sin, what is she trying to do?
Find out more about them.
Okay, so she wants to find out more about them. It could be that she's, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, and engage them.
Engage them, possibly help them. But there's also the possibility that she's suggesting that whatever Senia is doing for Rhea is not enough. You know, here you could work or you could, you know, and Senia makes things clear. She's the mother, she's making the decisions. And when she says no, it's no. Pam ran both hands through her curls. There's a law that even provides for homeschooling, sets down regulations, but the person who teaches has to take a test and a curriculum has to be followed and materials. Senior will probably meet the requirements, Pam shrugged. I doubt she's deigned to apply. Okay, this rule about homeschooling is totally irrelevant. Rules can be that way, right? They can be, you know, you can have a rule on the books that nobody follows. I mean, you know, it can be enforced. But there was no way that the authorities would have ever caught Xenia in the way she was homeschooling her daughter. They spent most mornings... Oh, go ahead.
Ivana, I'm sorry. If I could ask a question.
Sure.
So when Donna left, you know, tell us, was she talking to Xenia or was she talking to Beth and Pam and the other people? Because I took it she was talking to them. And what she was doing, or what they were doing, is kind of mocking the rules that Xenia has for... her daughter, one of the things I saw in this story was that rules are a way to differentiate. You know, the families of the kids that were left there didn't necessarily understand or buy into the rules that they had at the shelter. Mm-hmm. The women at the shelter didn't necessarily understand or buy into the rules of the relationship that Xenia had with her daughter.
Right, right. So, right, and that is the understanding that Donna is going to come to. She has her rules. She makes the rules at Donna's ladle. Xenia has her rules. And just because your rules are different from my rules doesn't mean that my rules are better than your rules. Although at the beginning she thinks maybe her rules are better. We're going to see that. But she's talking to Pam because Pam doesn't like to show off. And so Donna has to encourage her and say, tell us. You know about laws about homeschooling, so tell us. And then Pam does. And before they ate, they bowed their heads in silent prayer and then quietly, with perfect manners, dispatched whatever was before them. And then they returned to the room. There, Rhea sat on a low chair beside her mother with her book turning pages, rarely looking up. To the next page, 95. When Rhea did play, she played by herself, arranged the dollhouse, drew elaborate diagrams. Meanwhile, Xenia actually did crochet her hands and what does that say? Hook converting a ball of wheat colored thread into long loose fabric. The ball of thread lay and so on. Xenia was making Afghan strips or dresses, dresser scarves, or just yards of trimming. The woman was as silent and absorbed as her daughter. But once in a while, when one of the toddlers became difficult, she would put down her crocheting, rise from the chair, pick up the whining or bawling or flailing child. The child grew instantly quiet, either barring Xenia's composure or becoming paralyzed with terror. After a few minutes, Xenia set the youngster down and returned to her work, her scar glistening like the trail of a tear. This scar is different from the scar that we saw last week, right? Where it was a grapefruit knife. This sounds like it's a scar that has a tear behind it. Pam begins to lead after lunch discussions on self-esteem and expectations. Turn to 96. And there's Michelle, who's one of the Maeve volunteers who stays. The others don't, you know, kind of, their time with them is up, but Michelle is one of the ones who stays. Yeah, 97. The trouble swirled and then settled. Donna got up from Michelle, got help from Michelle, who thereby escaped from the lawyer's reminiscence. By 3 o'clock, most of the children and their mothers had been bundled out. Beth and some volunteers were putting the kitchen to rights. Michelle was singing to Africa. Pam was managing to calm Elijah's gorgeous turquoise-eyed mother, who claimed that her social worker had recommended prostitution as a career. Donna was mopping the dining room. Her social worker had recommended prostitution as a career. So Rhea and her mother have, they eat, they say their prayers, they go, she reads, and what we hear at the bottom of 97 is that Rhea is getting a phenomenal education from her mother. Many guests made use of the public library, but Senia and Rhea actually borrowed and returned books. They patronized the museum too. A volunteer had spotted them at a lecture on Dutch interiors. She's teaching her kid reads. She's getting an education in art. Pam had seen them at the State House listening to a debate on the budget. You know, everything. She's getting this very, very broad education. Those events were part of Rhea's schooling. They were fine arts and social studies fields trips, just like the ones taken by school children, but uncomplicated by questions of who would sit next to whom on the bus. Rhea would end up better educated than her cohorts. She'll get into Harvard, Pam had predicted. That's more than I did. But Donna thought that the girl would be better off in a classroom, learning to tolerate and interact and share. Schools weren't meant only for the likable. There must be a place for this scarily self-possessed miniature of her mother. Let Senior crochet in the corridor if the two couldn't bear separation. Let them practice their queer habits somewhere else. Goodbye. She watched them go. She leaned on her mop, letting her distaste for the pair flood her cheeks. So here's this case where Donna has her ideas, which is, it's, you know, the social part of school is more important than the education she's receiving. The motherly slaps and threats and insults she countenanced every day at the ladle didn't bother her as much as Senior's silence. She wondered if Senior controlled the girl by means of some drug undreamed of by street smart clientele of the ladle, brimstone maybe, bubbling on the stove in their basement apartment. You know, she has these ideas, and they're very judgmental, you know, for somebody who has learned not to judge many things. But here is a blind spot for her. And so she's definitely doing some judging here. Okay, 99. Donna turned her thoughts to current problems. The helping hands had dropped the ladle in favor of animal rights. The Maeve's attendance had slackened, though Michelle remained faithful. The price of vegetables was going up. Even broccoli was almost out of sight. Mice were running free in the pantry. Tomorrow, Thursday, might be a nightmare. Pam was to leave and lead an afternoon lunch discussion of empowerment, and who knew what would ensue. Last month, the empowerment session had ended in disarray. Skipping down to the bottom. In fact, the empowerment discussion went well. The guests who attended drafted a petition protesting budget cuts. Skip to the next page. The governor's representative jotted down some notes, but mostly he stared hungrily at Elijah's beautiful mother and her glossy hair braided like an Indian's bride, and her ivory skin and her long blue-green eyes. So the government worker too has his things that he's, you know, his motivations as well. And now it was Friday afternoon. Free Fruit had just been delivered, had just delivered several baskets of very soft tomatoes. The staff would stew them as soon as possible. Pam and Donna were separating the merely overripe from the absolutely rotten, right? These were, we had heard about that in the recipe story. I got a glimpse of Senia's handiwork the other day. What's it like? Like nothing I've ever seen. I can't imagine its purpose. A noose, maybe? She probably rips it out every night, like what's her name, Penelope. But Senia does make their clothing. She can do useful needlework. Maybe the coil is her hobby. Ugh. So they, all of them, have this idea about them. 101. Michelle, on her way to a weekend with her boyfriend, ran by, a toothy smile. Oh, Donna, I forgot to put away the cleaning button. Have to catch a bus. Sorry. Donna waved her on and went into the empty children's room to fetch the bucket. So here's the reality about volunteers, right? And Michelle's one of the best. She's the one who stuck around. But a volunteer is a volunteer, and they don't have to finish the job. It's the professionals, as it were, who have to, you know, the buck stops with them. And the volunteers are nice, but, you know, they're only as dependable, reliable as they are. And Michelle is a college student, and even though she's a great one and so on, okay. But she left the cleaning bucket there, and that's important because Donna's going to trip on it. And that's going to be an important moment there. But the children's room wasn't empty. Senia and Rhea sat on their low chairs facing each other. They were reciting something in words Donna couldn't catch, a tuneless but emotional song consisting of questions and responses. Senia intoned the questions, Rhea declared the responses. Senia's eyes were open, watching the girl with consuming interest. "You can't," Donna began, lurching forward, banging her shin on Michelle's pail. Rhea opened her eyes. Both Senia and Rhea turned to look at Donna, who was standing on one leg now, rubbing the other. "We can't what?" they seemed to be inquiring. What rule were they breaking? They were not drinking. They were not doping. They were not yelling. They were not striking each other. The tone of their liturgy was charged, but it wasn't abusive. How was Donna to finish her admonition? "You can't look peculiar. You can't try to save your child from corruption. You can't pray." So there are the rules that are on the books, and then there are the rules that are our internal rules, you know, our prejudices, right? Our prejudices and our biases, those are rules too, until we allow them to be questioned. And right now, Donna's rules, for herself at least, you know, her values are being questioned. What were they doing that was wrong? Why is it bothering her? "Sorry," she muttered, limping. She pushed the wheeled pail out of the children's room. The harsh duet resumed. Rhea's words sounded like numbers. Perhaps she was reciting the populations of the world's capitals. Just to the end of the page. At the same moment, a small figure with half a dozen arms and legs whirled into the dining room from the area of the bathroom, capturing the attention of all three. It was Elijah in flight. He scooted diagonally across the empty dining room, a pinwheel shooting sparks. Then his mother ran in too, her now unbraided satin hair streaming over her knapsack, a hunchback bird. "I'm gonna get you." What do you think about that? So here's Elijah, right? What a delicious description of a child, you know, all these arms and legs, like a pinwheel, right? Mm-hmm. You know, sparks of energy and life. And but the mother is hair streaming over her knapsack, a hunchback bird. "I'm gonna get you." There was a swoop. The pinwheel was caught. Why was she running after him?
Because it was a game.
Okay, so it was a game, or it was, or she was really going to get him, right?
Or he escaped.
Or he escaped, right. We heard something about Elijah at the beginning. I can't find it. Okay. There was a swoop. The pinwheel was caught, but his captor was not the raven, but the bat. The raven is his mother, right? The bat, Senia. She held him high above her upturned face. He grinned down at her. Her cape hung in a column behind her. Elijah's mother skidded to a stop. "My baby," she demanded. Rhea joined them. "I a plane," shouted Elijah, flapping his elbows. "Donna, I a plane." Rhea lifted her arms in imitation of her mother. Elijah's mother lifted her arms too. "My baby," she said in a softer voice. Senia placed Elijah in the girdle formed by Rhea's hands. Rhea held the child aloft for a moment, then passed him to his mother. She too held him briefly like a chalice before settling him on her shoulder and marching out. What just happened here?
It seems that Senia had the insight into what Elijah's mother needed to see about relating to her son.
Which was what? Right.
To treat him with love.
To treat him with love.
Rather than with the harsh, punitive approach that she had had.
Right, so the swoop that the raven was going to do, a raven is a kind of menacing type of bird, right? It's not it's not a like a happy dove kind of thing. And you think the bat might be too, a little bit. But no, this was my father's insight to this story, which was great. Because you have the bat who's wearing a cape, right? So you have the superhero, right? There's a swoop, but it's a redemptive, salvational swoop, because she holds him high and her face is upturned. Her daughter does the same thing, and the mother understands that this baby is holy. Like a chalice, she holds him, settling him onto her shoulder and marching out. These people who Donna had judged and this and that and so on, they transformed this moment, which may have gone, which may have gone into a bad moment. They were able to teach this mother about how to look at her child. Senya adjusted her cape, and then she turned to her daughter. They exchanged a long, silent stare, a gaze of peace and intimacy and intricately tangled pleasure. The space between them became briefly radiant. Donna, though blistered, watched. She wondered whether she would ever again pay honor to that meager virtue, getting along with people. She knew that she would never again claim to understand anything about mothers and children. They left. Donna walked into the kitchen. It would be a pleasure to stew tomatoes until they burst through their skins. So at this moment, when Senya and Rhea are looking at each other, Donna understands this, or she gets some insight into this mother-daughter relationship. There's peace, there's intimacy, there's pleasure. You know, all these things that she didn't see. She saw severity in the girl. She saw a kind of, a kind of silent and, impoverished relationship here, which it was absolutely not. They were looking at each other and they were radiant because they had just held a baby, right? And, and that was a pleasure for both of them. And there was love there. And Donna realizes that she would never again pay honor to that meager virtue of getting along with people. What meager virtue is she talking about? When she thought that Rhea would be much better off in school, it was because she wanted her to relate and to tolerate and all of these things. And now Donna realizes, that wasn't actually, that actually, in this case, Rhea is learning from her mother much, much more than that. She's learning how to love babies and other people and to understand the holiness of the human being. And that's not something she could have gotten in school. And so Donna actually says, you know what, to herself, we're learning. She gets it. She was wrong about this pair. She had judged them too quickly. So she walks into the kitchen. It's going to be a pleasure to do tomatoes because I know what tomatoes do. They burst through their skins, and they will make a stew. You know, tomatoes, at least I know I understand. And I'll make them, and I'll make them into food, and they'll be useful. I may not have gotten this right, but, there are some things that I do get right. And, it kind of goes to what we're now seeing as a theme in How to Fall, which is one of the ways that Edith Perlman thinks that we fall is we rush to judgment about people. And we don't know the facts that we need to know. And the question about falling there, as it is every time, is do you get up afterwards? And here what we see is Donna falls. She sees her fall. She sees why, where she fell and why. And she learned something from it. That's getting up. That's getting up and moving forward. And she learns. And this is a huge thing, so that when the next caped mother and caped daughter come in, she will be much, much more open to something that she wasn't open to before. And she'll, maybe she'll, you know, when there's even something else new, she'll remember that moment when she was wrong and not, you know, judge. And, you know, this is something where, you know, Edith Perlman is really trying to tell us something that we all know so well. You know, we just, you know, we see people, we see what they look like, and we do immediately judge them. And we have to work against it. You know, we have to work against our own first judgments of people until we ask some questions, until we do some inquiry. And even then, we always have to be somewhat humble about thinking what we know, because basically what Edith Perlman is showing us is that things, the way they look, you know, like the person not reporting abuse, right? It looks terrible, but it's only terrible if you don't know the bigger picture. And you'd only judge it if you don't know the bigger picture. And she's saying that is a pitfall for all of us. You know, so we have to work against it. You know, the rabbis in Pirkei Avot say, have they done a kol ha'adam l'kaf zchut? Judge all people favorably. He's saying something wonderful. He's saying, don't just judge people fairly. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Tip the scale toward favorability. That's what we have to cultivate in ourselves. Favorable judgment. When in doubt, don't judge negatively. And that's a tall order, but she gives us a couple of stories in which we see that, because I think she basically is an optimist about human beings, and part of the reason she writes the story she writes is she thinks we can learn. We can learn, and we can, you know, do better, and so on. Okay, other thoughts about the story?
I thought it was one of the better ones.
yeah, it's a wonderful story.
She seems to be taking us through this incredible, through all of these stories. We've gone through this amazing spectrum of people.
Yes.
And she pokes fun where we don't expect her to poke fun at people and supports what we don't expect her to support.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's one of the things that Edith Perlman really enjoys the most, which is knowing that she's going to surprise us. You know, which is such a, she is going to surprise us, and she lovingly lures us into, you know, whatever mistakes we're going to make, because she actually models for us non-judgmentalism, right? She is very, she shows us her characters, but she very rarely judges them negatively. You know, her point is really to show us people, but not to, you know, she's showing us people and she's showing us situations because we should make judgments about them. You know, ultimately we do need to make judgments, but she's trying to have, you know, really broaden our minds by surprising us and by showing us things that we don't expect. So another one. And that point about when it comes to rules, because this is about rules, you know, Donna had her rules, Senia had her rules, and Donna came to appreciate Senia's rules, right? Which she didn't have an appreciation before. So when you're around your Thanksgiving table and you're about to, something negative comes into the brain, just try to judge favorably, but have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving, everybody.
You as well.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Take care, everybody.